Welcome. My name is Patrick Curran, and along with my friend Greg Hancock, we make up Quantitude. We are a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In today's episode, we explore the presence of missing data, embracing the paradox that something can be both missing and present at the same time. We also discuss West Point, is versus are, middle school English teachers, relentless tenacity, talking narwhals, being completely pregnant, taking in shows at Cat's Cradle, circus tents, and books by Richard Bachman. We hope you enjoy today's episode. Good morning, Greg.
Hey, I want to tell you a story. You ready for a story?
I'm always ready for a story.
Okay. I was talking a while ago to this guy who does research for the Army. He's actually in the Army and he does research for the Army. And he does a lot of multi-level modeling. And he was telling me about this super cool multi-level model that he was working on and had to do with health and wellness outcomes for soldiers. And he started describing it. And if you think about it, right, there are squads within platoons, within companies, within battalions, within brigades, within divisions, within corps. I mean, it's potentially massive and cross-level relations, all this kind of stuff. So basically, somewhere there's a Jenga tower in the corner quivering in fear, just thinking about this particular model. And he asked me, so, you know, what do you think? And I said something, you know, like, that is about the coolest model I have ever seen that will never run. And, you know, super encouraging, I know. And he goes, why? I said, well, here's what I see happening. Missing data are going to fly in and napalm the hell out of your model. Right, trying to speak his language, to identify with my audience.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory.
He goes, what do you mean? I said, missing data at each of your 94 levels. He laughed and then he looked at me and he goes, this is the Army. There are no missing data. We order people to provide data. They provide data. The whole concept to him of missing data was really completely foreign. And it was such a fascinating disconnect. But I thought, what a cool world where you could live in. And I certainly don't live in that world.
I, too, worked with a buddy of mine who was on faculty at West Point. I went up to help him as a consultant. And he was a lieutenant colonel. We walked across campus and these 18-year-old kids would snap to the side and salute as he walked by. And he would flick off these salutes. And I thought, I could get used to this. And so when I came back to Carolina, I encouraged my students to salute me.
Uh-huh.
And needless to say,
right,
I didn't get a single salute.
They could do the flick off part, but not the salute part.
There was
part.
Some flicking going on, but it was mostly behind my back. No, missing data is fascinating. We've had a couple of episodes where we've talked about horrible terminology and missing data. And we did talk about the like missing not at random and missing completely at random. But another one that I like is you read this, and I've written sentences like this where you say the presence of missing data, right?
Right.
Can you estimate models in the presence of missing data?
That's one of those Zen conundrums that you just have to ponder. What is the presence of missing data? You know, it's like, wow, took me to a higher place. I have something even more basic than that. I don't know if I'm supposed to say missing data is or missing data are. So I am a data are guy, but missing data to me becomes its own entity and then it feels like a singular. So would you say missing data is really a problem or would you say missing data are really a problem?
I'm an are guy. Unless you are missing a single numerical value. So if you have an N by P data file and one value is missing, then it would be missing datum is.
Yes.
If you are missing two or more, missing data are.
Yeah, so I'm totally on board with the data are thing completely. But when people talk about it as the problem of missing data is really thorny, I guess that's the problem.
That is because it modifies problem.
Okay.
Right? My mom was a middle school English teacher.
Yeah.
I had no friends growing up, and there were a variety of reasons for that. not the least of which was at age 7, we would be out riding bikes. Mm-hmm. And my friend would say, me and Mike are going to go get a Coke. And I would say, Mike and I are going to go get a Coke. If you drop Mike, what are you left with? It is, I am going to go get a Coke. Uh-huh. I spent a lot of time on my own as a child.
Right. Wow. But you got a higher GRE verbal than I did. So good for you.
Barely.
Than me did. Okay. Yeah.
me and you done
than,
good.
Than me.
We've been taught good.
Yeah.
Yeah, missing data is funny because...
You just said missing data is funny.
Because it modified funny? God, I don't know. Missing data invokes passion and irrationality, I think.
All right, so let's talk about missing data. I think what you just brought up is going to be important along the way. Maybe that is to be a little bit formal in the definitions of what the different mechanisms might be. Talk about ways that we ought to deal with missing data. Maybe hint at some reasons missing data might in fact not always be such a bad thing. Is all of that sounding reasonable?
Yes.
Cool. And what I would also say, and I want to bump this up near the top, is that we should probably do some things to try to make sure that we don't have missing data in the first place. And that's where I would choose to start, unless you want to stick something in front of that.
So I will.
Okay.
What I'm thinking is we get missing data. Why is that? Well, there are a variety of reasons. We're not even talking about the mechanism. We're just talking about why might an individual not provide a numerical value to you? Things that I'm thinking about are you ask a sensitive question and they refuse to answer. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work I do is drug and alcohol use, underage, a lot of illegal behaviors. And despite all of our promising that we have an NIH certificate of confidentiality and no one will ever know this, that if I ask a 15-year-old in the last 30 days, how many times have you gotten drunk? And in the next room, my coworker is interviewing the kid's mom. Maybe the kid just says, yeah, I'm not going to respond to that. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a refusal. Maybe it's participant burden. Every one of us out there wants to ask 2 hours worth mm-hmm. of questions, and maybe we have 15 minutes of good participant time and they just skip a section because they're bored, they're tired, they're being forced to do it, they don't want to do it, whatever. And then the big one that's the poke in the eye for me is we interview them when they're age 6, we interview them when they're age 7, and then we can't find them when they're 8. They drop out of the study over time.
Well, those are big ones, and they're important because they telegraph how you might deal with it and how you might prevent it. But people might be insufficiently motivated to participate in whatever it is you're doing. They might be disinterested in what you're doing. They might not buy into what you're doing for whatever reason. Or the language that you are using on a particular instrument might not be aligned with the needs of a particular segment of the population. There's so many places where you have an opportunity to get missing data, and there's some control that you have as a researcher to try to prevent that.
I like how you say it telegraphs how might we work to avoid missing data in the first place. What are ideas you have?
Not a one in my head, but I have a number of colleagues who deal with real data, but a lot of the people with whom I interact and collaborate deal with populations that they're tracking longitudinally, whether it's infants or adolescents and so forth. And they encounter a lot of things, not just attrition, which you mentioned, but other things too. So I have one very good friend at Washington State University, Masha Gartstein, and she does things around the temperament and other developmental phenomena for infants and children. And I asked her just to spew a list of things that they do. And for some people, these would be pretty obvious. And for others, these might be just good ideas. And because we've participated in studies at various points in our lives, some of these might resonate. You know, if you deal with kids, having prizes for the kids, sometimes there are raffles. I see this all the time, you know, that you could win a prize, you could win a gift card. Sometimes if you have trouble keeping participants involved, you have to offer them rides to a place where there might be a location where the study is being done. Long-term studies will send out birthday cards, holiday cards to the participants, newsletters, summaries of findings. sometimes participation in a study will actually provide really interesting information to parents if you're studying children. So we will tell you some things about your kids, some interesting diagnostic things that you as a parent might find interesting. So keeping them involved in the science of it can be useful. I alluded to the readability or the language. I mean, do you have people who don't have English as a first language? Do you need to provide instruments or researchers who are capable in other languages? Because if someone comes and they've agreed to participate and they find the whole thing a very frustrating experience for reasons of communication, obviously you have to make a decision about whether or not that person is part of the population to which you wish to generalize. But if you're studying phenomena that have nothing to do with language, you should anticipate that particular problem. You know, if I summarized everything about this, it's really knowing who your subjects are, knowing who the population is that you are studying, and trying to anticipate some of the things that might be barriers for them to participate, whether they're motivational barriers or geographic barriers or language barriers, and trying to prevent that going in. So when someone just tells me, oh, we had a missing data problem, what I want to say is, well, what did you do on the front end to try to prevent that? And of course, the better conversation is before data are even gathered, making a really concerted effort to think about ways that you're going to prevent missing data in the first place.
I like all of those. I was very fortunate to be involved in a research project in grad school. Her name has come up on prior episodes, but Lori Chasson, and she did a long longitudinal study of intergenerational transmission of parental alcoholism to kids. She had an amazing retention rate, I mean, above 90%. Mm-hmm. And I would look and think about what did she do to achieve that? I think broadly speaking, there were two things, one of which you touched on. She made a really wonderful effort to make the families feel like they were part of something bigger, that they weren't just data providers, that there was this shared mission and we were in this together to improve humanity. And so I think that was really neat. And she had a variety of ways of doing that. The other one is also what I think is a great band name, right? At home with the family, somebody will say something, just during conversation, and somebody will shout out band name because it's just mm-hmm. a great band name. The most recent one was Two-Story Outhouse. Is one of my daughters, I don't even know how it came up, but one of them was, that's as smart as a two-story outhouse. And I thought, oh, I would go see them. Right. And so this would open for Two-Story Outhouse, uh-huh. which is relentless tenacity. Uh-huh. I've been involved with uh-huh. projects where they would contact them for their next assessment and they would say, I'm really busy. I just can't do it now. And they'd say, well, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And we had this young woman on the project at the time. I still remember her name was Polly. She was this wonderful young woman. And oh, my God. She was just like a blue tick hound with a bone on a porch. She would call back the next day and the next week. And at some point, somebody would say, I got an afternoon where you could send somebody over. It's being part of something bigger and relentless tenacity. Opening for Two-Story Outhouse, Friday at Cat's Cradle.
I like that. And I am pretty sure Polly now works at the Alumni Association that keeps stalking me for for donations, right?
Okay, so despite our best efforts, we still sure. get a rectangular data matrix that has dots in it.
So the language around missing data mechanisms is awful. We've talked about that previously. And it's one, as part of my time machine travels, I would handle this.
Is it language is or language are?
So the language be very challenging here. Well, missing completely random is actually what the name implies, that the holes that you have in your data matrix or the dots that you say that you have in your data matrix really are completely random. They depend on nothing. Well, there's supposedly a test of that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on the test of missing.
There is, and it's nice. It's by Rod Little. Back in the late 80s, he had a JASA paper on it, and it's a test of MCAR. And mm-hmm. so what we're going to move into in this discussion is you can talk about the data values themselves that are missing and then variables that are present in the data that are correlated with the data that mm-hmm. are missing. And so we have kind of exogenous variables or auxiliary variables, and then we have the data that are missing itself. And the MCAR is, it's actually pretty straightforward. You create two groups, who's missing, who's not missing, and then you compare them on variables that you do have. So you can look at gender, and you can look at alcohol use, and you can look at whatever. And you can do univariate tests, which are the usual t-tests and chi-squares. And Little's test is a multivariate generalization of that. And it's very nice, and it's elegant. Mm-hmm. I mean, for lack of a better description, it's kind of like a hotelling's t-squared. It's an omnibus test of whether there are patterns of missingness on what you observed as a function of whether you were in the complete case data or the partially missing case data groups. I like it. It's fine. Why I'm less enamored with it is there are modern approaches to handling missing data that establishing whether they're MCAR or not is not relevant. Mm-hmm. So back in the late 80s, it was important to establish, is it missing completely at random? Because we had limited ways of dealing with that, as there's listwise deletion, pairwise deletion, mean imputation, these more traditional things. Well, now we have two methods that we'll get into, maximum likelihood-based and multiple imputation-based, that we don't have to assume MCAR, we can assume MAR, and... Mm-hmm. I'm less interested in a formal test of that. And indeed, if somebody is doing really good due diligence in a paper and presents Little's test of MCAR, I'll often recommend they drop it because I don't find it useful.
I would take it a step further and underscore some words that you said in your description of that. You said, on the variables that we have, or on the variables that are available. And missing completely at random and missing at random, it's not just about being related to the variables you have in the data set. It's all variables in the universe of variables. And so this particular test can't assess whether or not your data are missing as a function of a variable that you have failed to gather. So to me, it is a very tightly contained test that assumes that you've got everything on the table. And if you don't have anything on the table, something on the table that's relevant, then I think the test is not particularly useful. I will usually tell my students that the best test of whether or not your data are missing completely at random is if a unicorn canters by with a talking narwhal on its back, then you just might have missing completely at random. And you might also have multivariate normality and maybe independence of observations too. It's the narwhal test, I would say.
I really need to take one of your classes. Missing completely at random is the equivalent of you have a complete data case, you generate random numbers, and you punch those numbers out, and they're unrelated to the numerical value themselves that's missing or any variable in your data set. Missing at random, so generalize that for me.
Missing at random is when the process of missingness that you have does depend on a variable or variables. You have those variables in your system, but it does not depend on each individual datum's value, what it would have been. So if you ask me my weight and I fail to give you the information about my weight, if it is because of my weight, then that's missing not at random or not missing at random. But if it is because of some other variable, something that may be a personality characteristic, and that's part of the data set, then we could characterize this as missing at random. And I think the name is absolutely horrible, but the idea is that if you condition on this variable, then it does become random.
I think that's one of the few times that the equations really help highlight that mm-hmm. is when you look at the conditional probability expression for missing completely at random, you have some multivariate distribution that just exists without condition variables. And then missing at random is it's random given, right? The conditional line, that pipe, the vertical line, given your covariate. So it's conditionally random. But it is awful. It's kind of like being completely pregnant or being pregnant. It's like, okay. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. You can do due diligence and form these groups on who has complete data, who has missing data, and then do t-tests and chi-squares on gender, on diagnosis, on age, on ethnicity. And on all of those, you can have big, significant differences in that one gender is more likely to be missing, one race is more likely to be missing, one age is more likely to be missing. Under MAR, that's actually not a problem. Mm-hmm. Because if we have those variables in the data set and incorporate them, and we'll get to that into a moment, incorporate them either into the model or in our approach for imputing missing cases, then when other assumptions are met, that's fine. And it is very hard to describe that you're five times more likely to be missing on a particular item if you're female versus male, but that if we include biological sex as a covariate, that it's conditionally at random. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm covering my butt on this, is when we meet other assumptions, yep. right? When we meet other assumptions, that's perfectly fine. And it, yes. it's hard to get your head around.
Yeah, that's right. So the last category then is the, do you call it not missing at random or missing not at random?
Missing not at random.
Missing not
at random. Just to meet the original acronym, M-N-A-R. Okay. And yes. even M-N is hard to say, yeah. right? N-M is easier, M-N. So everybody listening, try, say out loud, M-N,
M-N, N-M.
N-M. M-N-A-R.
Oh. M-N-A-R. Yes, yeah. you're right. Thank you. Yeah, so missing not at random is the example that I gave you when I don't give you my weight because of what my weight is. And you can't ascertain that for sure because I didn't give you my weight. You can't tell specifically if people of a certain weight are less likely to provide information about their weight or not because you don't have those particular data. But when your data are missing not at random, then potentially you're in a bad, bad place. You're in a bad, bad place unless you are able to, and this is in line with what you said, unless you are able to get variables that are or are reasonable proxies of that missing mechanism.
We could build a quantitude list of things that if you want to be a wiener when you're reviewing a manuscript, demand that empirical evidence be presented to definitively establish that the missing data mechanism is not MNAR. Because it's the beauty of uh-huh. tautological cycles, which I saw at the Cat's Cradle last weekend. Uh-huh. The very nature is the numerical value is missing because of the numerical value that's missing. Now, here's uh-huh. the cool thing, though, and I know you're a big fan of auxiliary variables.
Yes.
Here's another thing that I think is a misunderstanding, is often I will talk to students or colleagues who believe that MNAR is a fixed characteristic of the data. So mm-hmm. if you have a missing not at random, that it's like, sorry, you lose. Well, that's actually not the case. For those of you who are interested in this, just go read Craig Ender's book. Craig has a book from, is it maybe 2010?
Yep.
I should yes. have looked it up, but it's 2010. We've established on prior episodes that I love tight titles, and it's Applied Missing Data Analysis.
Done.
In and out, nobody gets hurt. But Craig is a great guy. He's super smart. He's out at UCLA. If you want to know anything about missing data, just go get Craig's book. It's everything that you need to know about missing data. And he has a really nice section in there where he describes how you can have an MNAR condition, but if you're able to obtain external variables, maybe they're covariates that would go into your subsequent model. Maybe they're what Greg will talk a little bit about, these auxiliary variables that are correlated with the variable that's missing, but maybe you're not going to use it in a subsequent SEM or regression or whatever you're going to do. But you can use modern methods of missing data estimation to convert MNAR data to MAR data. And it's almost magic. Like there's a magical element to it, as MNAR is not a fixed characteristic of your data. It might be, because if you don't have auxiliary variables that allow you to do that, then that is a fixed attribute of the data. But you should think about these missing data as something that is actually malleable. We can convert one mechanism to another if we have proper variables and use them appropriately in the missing data estimation.
Yes. And I think that's a nice lead in to maybe we can talk a little bit about these modern methods we keep dancing around and then circle back to that idea of an auxiliary variable. Does that sound okay?
Before you start with modern, I'll do the tradition, right? Because sure. I'm the world's youngest old man. I alluded to these very briefly, and we absolutely don't have to delve into them. Again, Craig's book has a really nice summary of these. But back in the day, right, we've talked in a prior episode, is be careful what historical lens that we use to look 20 years ago, because somebody's going to be looking at us right now 20 years in the future. And so we have to put ourselves back in the 1980s when we didn't have multiple imputation and we didn't have full information maximum likelihood, yet we still wanted to learn something from our data. We could use listwise deletion. So if anybody was missing something on anything, you're out. It's like you never existed. Mm-hmm. We could do pairwise. So we build a covariance matrix or a correlation matrix using whatever variables are available for those pairs. Problems with that, tough to invert. They're often not positive definite. Some clever ones, we can use mean imputation. So you take the mean of everybody who does have data, and anybody who doesn't gets that mean value. If it's longitudinal, you can do this last value carried forward. That's kind of clever, as if you interview me three times and I give values of 1, 4, and 4, and then I'm missing the next one. Give me a 4. Mm-hmm. I mean, how bad can that be? That turns out pretty bad.
Science!
We lose power because we throw away information when we delete. It introduces bias. It undermines efficiency. It expands confidence intervals. And then the biggest one is, what is the poke in the eye? It really does relate to internal and external validity. Internal is it can build in biases and your modeling processes only for those who gave you complete data. And then that in turn impacts external validity, because external validity is the generalization of findings across person, place, and time based on the characteristics of who was studied in the data. And it's not everybody who you wanted. It's a subset of people who you wanted. So those are the traditional ones. So tell us about the more modern approaches.
Well, the traditional ones, as you said before, tend to rely on talking narwhals and the assumption of missing completely at random. The more modern methods that we use, and by the way, that doesn't mean that these more modern methods are baked into software packages necessarily, right? Some they are and some they aren't, but you might be in some general purpose software package and find that, heck, it's listwise deleting stuff and you don't even know it. You know, if you're doing some version of a repeated measure analysis, you go, whoa, what happened? Why do I have such a small sample? Because anybody who was missing anything at any time point, bye-bye. So you really have to be in tune with what's going on in whatever software that you're using. The more modern methods that we often talk about that have been shown to be reasonable under different scenarios include multiple imputation and full information maximum likelihood. I'll tell you my bias, and you might disagree with this, and that is that I think multiple imputation is good for some things, but I don't generally gravitate toward that. I tend to gravitate much more toward full information maximum likelihood. First of all, you may choose to disagree, and second of all, we should probably give a description either way.
So I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I like multiple imputation. Often it's just called MI. If we use that as a throwaway line, is there's FIML, is full information maximum likelihood, and MI. And again, why we don't have many friends outside of the psychology building or ed building is we say things like, well, did you use FIML or MI for MCAR or MAR? If you teleport back to the important early work, so Rubin, Schaefer, Graham, Linda Collins, Craig Enders contributed to this, it's based on what I described earlier, where you literally impute a missing value and then treat it as if you had obtained that value. Now, the traditional way is it would just do that one time, as you would take the mean or the mean of items. There are a whole variety of different ways you could do it. But that if I was missing a particular value, you took the mean on everybody else and gave me a 5, then you would fit the model with my value being 5. But the problem is that's treated as if that were the value that I would have given had you asked me. And it's not. It's your guess of what the value is of what I would have given you had you asked me. And remember, one of the core tenets of quantitative methodology is it really truly is an inherently fair endeavor, right? That's not fair. I didn't give you a 5, so you shouldn't pretend like I gave you a 5. And so what multiple imputation does to varying degrees, and it gets much more complicated, I mean, as you would imagine, is this gets quite interesting and quite complicated. But the multiple imputation part is it starts with the premise and says, well, that 5 is just really a random draw from some underlying distribution of potential values that you're going to give. And so we're not going to give you just one. We're going to give you 10 of them or 20 of them. You impute 20 different data sets, each of which has maybe a 4.8, a 5.2, a 3.6, maybe a 6.9, whatever. You fit 20 different models to 20 different data files. You gather together 20 different results, and then you combine them in pretty well-established ways that are functionally taking averages. They're not. They're more complicated than that. And then that's the multiple imputation. I like it in principle. I am much more a FIML guy because, as you're about to describe, instead of doing the process that I just described of generating 20 data files and fitting 20 models, you fit a single model, but you use a maximum likelihood estimator that accounts for differential contributions of data across individuals.
But let me just add a couple of things to multiple imputation. There are some types of models where I like MI better, and you know, like regression. Yeah, doesn't bother me that much. It has technically the flexibility to use any estimation procedure you want. So FIML, full information maximum likelihood, obviously is going to be embedded within a maximum likelihood estimation framework. But multiple imputation, you have the ability to analyze your imputed data sets however you wish. And that allows you to do, for example, OLS regressions and other techniques that are least squares based, or if there were other estimators as well. So I think that speaks in favor of multiple imputation. What I don't like about multiple imputation is when data model fit assessment, which we talked about in a recent episode.
The Black Pearl.
Yeah, nice. The curse of the Black Pearl. give me one more pirate, because you're really good at the pirate thing.
The pirate code is more guidelines than actual rules.
That is very good.
It's all I got. I'm done.
No, but it helps having been raised by a pirate, no doubt. Multiple imputation for models where fit is involved, I think, becomes a little bit more challenging, and maybe you have a workaround for this too. But if I create 20 imputed data sets and I fit my model 20 times, and we will say that it is an over-identified model, which means there's an opportunity for that model to perform imperfectly, which we consider in a Popperian way a good thing. What do I do? How do I aggregate fit? What happens if I find that in 14 of my 20 replications, the fit is what I would deem acceptable, and in 6, it's not acceptable? It's not entirely clear to me how fit and multiple imputation talk to each other. And maybe you know of some resolution to that, but I'm not really aware of that.
I don't have a resolution to that. I actually have a more basic concern, and it goes back to the OLS regression. And this is something, again, that Craig talks about really nicely in his book, as does John Graham and Joe Schaefer. They have a couple of really nice papers. Linda Collins is part of that as well. Let's say you have two predictors, X and Z, then some outcome Y. And one of the really nice things about MI is you build these 20 data matrices. If you're on a bigger research group, these can be posted in some shared mothership that everybody can work off of the same data files. I mean, there are a lot of advantages to MI. But if you impute the data where you build an imputation model that includes X and Z and Y, but not the interaction between X and Z. And then you fit an OLS model where you estimate the interaction. So the imputation model has two main effects, but the fitted model has two main effects and an interaction. You can actually suppress part of that interaction effect because it wasn't represented in the imputation model. And so it's a little misleading to say that the imputed data sets are agnostic to models, right? There's a really nice draw to say, well, you have these 20 data sets and you can go do anything you want with them. It's not actually true. Again, this isn't like a pervasive problem. MI is really powerful. It's very useful. There are situations where this should be used in practice. But in the spirit of Dirty Harry and knowing your own limitations, they are somewhat model dependent. And what my worry is, the opposite, is what if you, in your imputed model, put an XZ interaction, and then you fit an XZ interaction, and you find evidence for an XZ interaction? Seems like the fix is in.
Right, that's right. And feels like cheating.
So MI is great. I really like MI. A lot of it, it's automated in different packages. You and I are intentionally agnostic with software. It's in some, it's not in others. It's automated in some, it's not automated in others. Mm-hmm. But there are many reasons, and this is the big caveat, for the kind of things that you and I do, that FIML is a superior option.
Absolutely. So is this the part where you want me to say some stuff about FIML?
This would be the part that I want you to say some stuff about FIML.
All right. Some stuff about FIML. Here we go. Full information maximum likelihood. Yeah, I don't know.
Not what I was hoping for. No? Maybe you could expand that just a hair.
What I meant by that.
In your sigh.
My sigh. Yeah, let me unpack that sigh for our audience.
I'm tired.
Yeah. Let me explain full information maximum likelihood, first of all. And there are different ways to explain it. I will start actually with an antiquated way of explaining it. And that is the way full information maximum likelihood was operationalized early on. And there's some nice work, I think, by Paul Allison in the 80s, for example, where imagine that you could take all of the data that you have and form piles of unique patterns of missingness. So I have, just for simplicity, imagine I have some model that only involves three variables. So I have all the people who have provided me complete data, and I put you in pile number one. And I like you guys a lot. Thank you very much for all your help. And I make a pile of people who are only missing X1, and a pile of people only missing X2, a pile of people only missing X3, and then all the combinations down to the people who only provide a data on X1, X2, X3. So just with only three variables, there are a lot of potential different combinations of missing data patterns. And then I think about whatever model it is I am interested in testing. What I'm going to do is I am going to, and this is where it's going to feel a little bit tricky, I'm going to fit my model to each one of those subsamples, not separately, simultaneously. And it should be obvious that some of those subsamples really can't contribute to the estimation of all aspects of my model. So my model involves X1. All those people who don't have X1 can't contribute to information about parameters that have to do with X1. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to fit this model or parts of my model to all of these different subsets. And the key is that I am going to constrain every single parameter that I have to be equal across all of these subsets. Everybody contributes to informing the parameters for which they have data, and they don't contribute to informing the parameters for which they do not have data. But at the end, I get out one single parameter estimate for every parameter in my model. I get out an assessment of overall fit. I have not imputed any data at all. And the idea of not imputing data is very attractive. The idea of getting out standard errors, getting out single parameter estimates where I don't have to aggregate a bunch across a bunch of subsamples, all of this is extremely attractive to me. This is an old way of thinking about it, but I think it's a useful starting point. Is that okay with what I said?
Absolutely. And I don't know how much we need to get into the weeds of the modernization of that. When I teach it, at least in a non-technical way, I kind of view a line of people that go up to the counter and they put on the counter whatever data it is that they offered, mm-hmm. right? And maybe they have all of it, maybe they have some, maybe they have nearly none. And that data is contributed to the likelihood that's defined by the model that you estimate. And those individuals who have more data, that they carry more voice. They contribute more to that likelihood than those who have fewer data, or at least not, you know, in the parts of the model at which they give those data. And one of the real advantages to me goes back to that XZ interaction. Mm-hmm. If you have X and Z, and then you estimate a model in which that has a multiplicative interaction, that actually then just goes into, in part, defining the likelihood of the model, and you don't have that problem that comes up with MI. because the X and the Z and the XZ product are just now another variable that goes into whether you have data or not and whether it's weighted into the likelihood or not. So yes, I agree. And I think it's a wonderfully elegant procedure because the general technique applies to whatever parameterization of the model you estimate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you that we don't have to get too much into the weeds. There are sort of the next level explanation of it, the next level, the next level, the next level, all the way down to the formal representation of it in terms of likelihoods. I actually give an explanation in my class that involves circus tents and shadows. But
seriously, I'm going to have to make time to go do this. Circus right. tents and shadows. I'm
talking on walls.
Not to be repetitive, but go look at Craig's book. Mm-hmm. Craig has, I think, one of the clearest explications of traditional normal theory maximum likelihood mm-hmm. and then generalizing it to full information maximum likelihood. And I actually completely plagiarize part of his chapter in my own teaching mm-hmm. because I think that the clarity of it is so nice.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. He's a wonderful teacher and explainer of things. He uses words in his book along with formulas. He's terrific. So when we come back now to the assumptions and the mechanisms, when we're in the full information maximum likelihood world, you know, it's great if the data are missing completely at random, if they're talking narwhals and all that, but we're in the missing at random world, which is very, very nice. And I don't know what the f- to say about that. Okay.
We invoke assumptions. And again, we're getting deep into the discussion, and I don't think we need to delve down into the technical details, but we have similar kinds of assumptions that are invoked by maximum likelihood with sufficient sample size where asymptotic properties kick in. We have continuity. We have normality. These can be loosened as because these same FIML methods can be applied to discrete measures, and we can use robust standard errors and things. I mean, it really is a workhorse. Can I be grumpy old man for a moment?
Yeah, please. Sure.
Well, you paused. Is there another point you want to make on FIML before I start to grouse?
It was just to tie back to the auxiliary variable issue.
Go.
Was
so raised. Talk about that before I begin to grouse.
Yeah, sure. The assumption about data being missing completely at random, and you had alluded to this earlier, is sometimes able to be met by making sure that we have the mechanisms of missingness or the proxies of mechanisms for that missingness represented within our model. So if we think that the missingness that we are experiencing is due to something that is socioeconomic, and we already have socioeconomic variables in our model, then we're probably in a really good place. On the other hand, if we don't have those socioeconomic variables in our model, then we have a problem. The trick is we want to do it in, well, first of all, we had to know ahead of time to gather it. And that involves knowing your population, anticipating what some of the mechanisms, reasons people don't provide data might be. But second of all, we want to get it into our model in a way that doesn't undermine the integrity of the model that we already have. One of the really nice ways to do that is, you mentioned Graham earlier, something called the saturated correlates model, where you take these variables that you think are related to the missing data mechanism, but you introduce them in a way that is what we might call structurally benign, in a way that doesn't undermine the integrity of the model that you have. And it's a very clever way to build them into a structure so that, in essence, whatever information they bring to the model is quickly used up in the form of parameters that get estimated. But what you now have, ideally, is that the missingness that occurs is now conditioned on that variable being part of your model. And so you are meeting the assumption of the data being missing at random.
Craig has a really nice path diagram in mm-hmm. his book that shows when you have exogenous variables that are structurally related to the dependent variable, but how you can bring in auxiliary variables that are correlated with the predictors and correlated with the disturbance of the dependent variables, but aren't functionally related to the dependent variables. Because mm-hmm. one point of confusion even 10 years ago was, well, if you think socioeconomic status is associated with missingness, well, then you have to bring it in as a predictor. in your model, and theory may not call for that, or it may be inconsistent with what you're hypothesizing, auxiliary variables sidestep that. You can still bring that information to bear in the estimation of the model, whether it be NMI or FIML. Auxiliary variables apply to both.
And that's the clever trick that keeps it as a correlate, that keeps it as a something that is structurally benign. And the term saturated, as in saturated correlates, implies that it is related to everything, but in a way that doesn't otherwise disturb what you have. It's very clever. It's lovely.
It's interesting because when you look at the path diagrams of what we just described, actually your heart rate should go up a little bit because it looks like you're violating Gauss-Markov. So one of the key assumptions we invoke in a general linear model is your predictors are not correlated with the disturbance. They're independent. That's the whole endogeneity problem that econometrics deals with and trying to find instrumental variables and two-stage least squares and all of that. And so when you look at the path diagram, you're like, oh, crap, my predictors are correlated with my disturbance. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem here because of what we described.
Yeah.
Now can I grouse?
Nope. Wait,
okay.
Can I say one more thing about auxiliary variables?
And go, then I know that you're a big auxiliary.
Sure,
is it auxiliary or auxiliary? Or just extra?
Siri? I don't know. I pronounce the I, but I know a lot of people don't.
I'm just going to go with extra.
Okay. Here's something that people have done. And because you are involved in a lot of longitudinal research, a lot of really, really wonderful longitudinal methodology, you might have a particular opinion on this, but sometimes people will ask when you're doing longitudinal study whether or not a person intends to come back the next time around. At the end of the data gathering, the question might be something like, we've been so glad to have you participate in the study so far. You've been such an important part of this line of research. Your participation has been incredibly helpful. How committed do you feel to returning for the next wave of data? And the two-part beauty of that is, one, it tries to reinforce what people have already been doing. And also, if they don't come back, then you have what might be a wonderful auxiliary, very auxiliary. Dang it. auxiliary variable to incorporate into the model that's very predictive of that comes later. What do you think about that?
I'm so glad you raised that because that's something I completely forgot. We have this very strong research institute on campus. It's a 100 years old Odom Institute in Social mm-hmm. Sciences. And I went over to a talk on that. And the whole talk was based just on this. And as you said, it's a wonderful double message is your participation is so important to us. We're so happy that you're part of what we're doing here, but it was on a 0 to 100, how likely do you think it will be that you will continue in the study? And you can use that going back to that notion that you can convert an MNAR to an MAR mechanism. If you have an observed variable that is correlated with the missing value that you don't have in your data file, that becomes an auxiliary variable.
What made me think of it was I collaborate with a lot of people who do longitudinal research, and someone was crafting this kind of item for the first time. And I found the wording maybe a little bit off. It wasn't exactly like this, but when I read it, I felt like it read sort of like, some people are total losers and they don't come back. Mm-hmm. We don't think you're a loser. So what's the likelihood you're going to come back? And maybe we could soften the language a little bit and make it more encouraging. But I think it's a very clever idea for both of those values. All right. I need you to grouse. Unleash the fury.
Okay. So we got only a few minutes left. I will grouse a little bit. And I'm mostly going to grouse about things that I've done myself. And so yet again, it's not the self-righteous high road. Mm-hmm. They'll be in Raleigh in June. So I'm going to...
With the two-level outhouse?
Two-story outhouse.
Okay.
Yeah. No, two-level outhouse is just cliche and derivative.
Okay.
Two-story outhouse. They're really indie rock.
Yeah.
Given these modern methods, whether it be MI or whether it be FIML, and we haven't talked in detail. We really could talk about this all day long, and at this rate, we're going to. So forgive us on that. But FIML is used in structural equation modeling. It's used in standard multi-level models. I have written myself, and I try not to, But in a manuscript, try to avoid saying, we estimated the model using full information, maximum likelihood, and thus missing data are not an issue here. All right, I've done that myself.
Mm-hmm.
You still need to give a paragraph that mm-hmm. describes to the reader, what is the nature of the missing data? Is it associated with covariates that you have? Is it associated with potential auxiliary variables? There are different patterns of data. Is it monotonic? Is it non-monotonic? Can you give some graphical representations of the missing data? But describe to your reader the nature of the missing data that you have. And remember, we've talked on prior episodes about how we're like a prosecuting attorney and we're making a case to the jury. Is it just a paragraph is all, but convey to the reader why it's okay to make an MAR assumption and why FIML or MI is appropriate for your particular application. I admit I have 20 manuscripts where I say FIML was used and missing data is not an issue. I need to go back and do those kinds of comparisons more myself. It's less of a grousing and more of a keep your head up. Don't pretend like missing data is no longer an important topic. It is an important topic, although we are blessed to have very well-developed ways to allow us to do things in the presence of missing data.
Nice. Right. Can I put a wrapper around that?
Go for it.
Right. Was there more grousing or is that just the keep your head up?
I have another heads up. I'm going to recast it from grousing to heads up.
Okay, good. Do you want to add your other heads up before I put a wrapper?
I do want to add another heads up, and it's related to this point, and it is beware the conditional likelihood. I think that was a Stephen King book.
Yes. Yeah. One of the short stories, one of the Richard Bachman books.
It was under Richard Bachman, Beware the Conditional Likelihood. Everything we've talked about is Y-side. It's a whole nother hour episode, but they're joint likelihoods where you tried to build the joint distribution of your exogenous endogenous, and there are conditional likelihoods where you're trying to build the multivariate distribution of your endogenous given your exogenous. All right, particularly in the multi-level model, everything that we've talked about for the last hour applies to your dependent variable. It does not apply to your independent variables because that's on the right-hand side of that conditional statement. And so if you're predicting alcohol use and you have 22% missing data, FIML is going to work under the assumptions that we have. But if you have six predictors and you have missing data on two or three of them, do you know what every program on the face of the planet is going to do? Is listwise deletion. So keep your head up about that. Now, there's some recent work on how to handle that. That actually, Greg, is a nice example where MI can be used to impute exogenous side. You can sometimes trick models where you move exogenous over to the endogenous side, but that's an MLM. But I got to tell you, it's very frustrating because some SEM software packages estimate conditional likelihoods. Some SEM packages estimate joint likelihoods. If you have the same data file and the same model and you estimate it in two different programs, not only can you get different findings because the conditional likelihood strips out any missing data on your X side. So this is just a heads up, beware. I tell all my students is look at the top of your program and make damn sure you have as many variables and as many cases as you think that you have, because there are programs that will strip them out. Now, SEM software packages that by default have a conditional likelihood, it's pretty straightforward to trick it. Right. So what you do is if you have an exogenous variable, right, some predictor variable, is just define a mean and a variance for it, and it will switch it over to the other side of the likelihood. So it's a very easy fix, but it's a dangerous one if you're not careful. Because not only are you having listwise deletion of cases that you don't know it, but say that you're being conscientious and you're doing some model building. And so you have three exogenous variables, and then you incorporate three more, and then you incorporate two more. You can have different sample sizes across those three models because it's listwise deleting any X side variable that has missing data. So it's not grousing, it's a warning.
Yeah.
Beware.
That leads me to, I made a list because I know how important lists are to you. I have three things on my list. Is that okay?
Go for it.
All right. So the first one is a reiteration of what you said in your first keep your head up point. The way I think about it is when I'm working with someone to write a grant proposal, we have a missing data section. And the missing data section is not we will use FIML. The missing data section is part one, all the things that we will do to prevent missing data that show we are completely in tune with this population. We worked with this population before. Here are the ways that we're going to prevent missing data. Step two, how we are going to analyze the data using the information that we have gathered, the assumptions underlying the methods that we're going to use to analyze these data with respect to missingness, which will usually be something FIML-based, how we are meeting assumptions associated with FIML, particularly around missing at random and the incorporation of auxiliary variables that we had the foresight to gather, even if they're not explicit parts of the hypotheses that we do, and discussing then, telegraphing that what we will talk about in the future when the paper is done, what those particular assumptions are, just reiterating those. And all of that, to some extent, when you write a paper, gets condensed down, but you have to have a bit of a diary showing what you did to prevent it, what you did to handle it, and what you did to diagnose the assumptions underlying it. And let the reader, like with everything else, decide whether or not what you have done is reasonable. Most of the time in my experience, if you go through those kinds of things, reviewer two and all the other reviewers will view that as a pretty good faith effort to dealing with this particular problem. That was point one. Anything you want to say about point one?
I agree.
Okay. Thank you. Point two, which is really unrelated, a question that people ask me all the time is, I have X percent of missing data. Do you think it's going to be okay? I have 30%. I don't even know what 30% means. Does that mean 30% of your cases have at least something missing? Do you mean 30% of all the entries in your N by P data matrix are, I don't even know what that means. But anyway, it doesn't matter what you mean because I can't answer it. How much missing data are too much, not enough? It's a very difficult thing to answer because each missing data, or let me say this differently, each datum is really worth a different amount to your model. If you have a bunch of variables that are all measuring things that are similar and they're in your model for some reason and you're missing something on one of those variables, your model yawns. If you are missing something on a key predictor and it is the only measure that you have of that and there aren't any other variables that you would consider reasonable correlates of that, the cost of a missing datum on that variable could be enormous. So I don't know in terms of estimation. I don't know in terms of covariance coverage, you know, whether or not you have representation jointly on variables. I don't know in terms of power. So the question, how much is too much or not enough or whatever, I simply don't know how to answer that. And I don't know that it's answerable.
My corollary to that is when asked, is your data MCAR, MAR, or MNAR? My answer is invariably yes.
Yes. Exactly.
Because that's another thing to consider is that all three of those mechanisms can exist simultaneously. And what we're trying to do is strive to do the best possible job we have with the data available, knowing what the limitations and assumptions are, and pulling out our poking stick when possible and saying to what extent are the core conclusions that I'm drawing stable across different assumptions, different inclusions of auxiliary variables or whatnot. I agree. So you have point three.
I have point number three. And point number three is looking to the future. Point number three is, well, really a request of you. And that is, you know, we tend to talk about missing data as this thing that we have to deal with. For me, what we've been talking about so far has not been a curse the darkness episode. It has been a light a candle kind of episode. Yes, these things occur and there are ways to deal with it. Be mindful, be careful, keep your head up.
And we're really good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are really good ways to deal with these
things.
Yes. We can break it. If you have 90% missing data, you've got other problems to deal with. But in the majority of cases that the majority of us work in, we have really well-developed strategies for dealing with this.
Absolutely.
So let's go back to the future.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Ooh, okay. So the future is the idea that, in fact, missing data might not just be a nuisance that we have these ways to try to deal with, but in fact, missing data could be something that is beneficial. You had mentioned at the beginning about there are a lot of reasons that people might fail to provide missing data. And one of those reasons could be fatigue, right? Responder burden. There are a variety of other reasons as well. And so the question is there a way to design studies where we maybe allow missing data? Not only allow missing data, but control missing data. Maybe don't ask for everything from everybody in a move toward trying to maybe even enhance the validity of some of the quality of information that we are getting. And what my request, my look toward the future might be with you is if we set aside time for an episode to talk about what is often described as planned missing data designs. What do you think?
I think that's one of the most important things to wrap up with is everything that we've talked about is it's almost being on defense, right? Here's what we got. Here's what was given to us, or here's what we gathered and how do we deal with it? And I view this as being more, okay, now let's play on offense, which is given the incredible elegance of MI and FIML and other related techniques, let's use that to our advantage. Very briefly, as we could give subsets of questionnaires across groups to protect against fatigue. Something that's really important in my neck of the woods is a cohort sequential design. Mm-hmm. And so we stack data where we only gather 3 years of data from any one person, but we can string it out over a decade of developmental coverage.
Yeah, you can do designs where you have a combination of measures that are considered more expensive, higher validity measures, along with some that might be a little bit cheaper. Sometimes it's called a two-method measurement design. Yep. Yeah, there are a lot of possibilities. And I think if we dedicate a future episode, in a near future episode, to this particular topic, it might open up a really nice panorama of possibilities for our listeners.
Related to that, and this could be a standalone episode, but another big one in my neck of the woods is integrative data analysis. So you combine existing data. And again, a lot of that is done defensively. There's study A exists, B exists, C exists, and here's how we try to stitch them together. But a lot of effort at the level of NIH and NSF and IES has started to say, well, let's design studies, individual studies, in anticipation of combining these. And if you guys give these items, and you guys give these items, and you guys give these items, in 5 years, we're going to be able to stitch those together in a way that's as if you all gave all the item. This might be a good wrapping up point.
Do it. Let's hear it.
Wow. You're going to throw that back. I got nothing. Thank you so much, everybody. As always, we hope you have found this either useful or entertaining or some interstitial region between the two.
And we look forward to chatting with you all later.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Q-Potters. Be sure to tell your friends to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they prefer to get their low-budget home-brewed podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @QuantitudePod, and visit our website, quantitudethepodcast.org, where you can leave us a text or a voice message. You've been listening to Quantitude. It's as if Beavis and Butthead stumbled through a wormhole into academia. Today's episode has been sponsored by the five-way interaction. Go ahead, interpret it. We dare you. And by that fifth dentist who did not recommend Trident sugarless gum. And by the people who turned us down when we asked them to the prom. How you like us now? This is most definitely not NPR.